Cloud Computing Show, episode number 16. My name is Gary Orenstein, host of the Cloud Computing Show. And with me today is Mark Rischer, the Senior Director of Product Management and Spam Czar of Yahoo. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, thank you.
And just in spirit of full disclosure, Mark and I have known each other for a while, so we're friends, but also have been in different parts of the industry together. And today we're actually going to focus the show predominantly on Hadoop, where Mark's been spending a lot of time at Yahoo working on Hadoop. So we'll get into that in more detail later on in the show. Just wanted to go through, we have quite a few news items. I'm going to run through those fairly quickly. Of course, we have links to all the news items in the show notes at thecloudcomputingshow.com. One of the big things just came up this week is speculation on Apple's new data center. Evidently, they're building a $1 billion data center in North Carolina, and the speculation is that they're going to be offering some kind of cloud computing. Well, I don't know if that's really speculation or a done deal based on the fact that they're spending money pouring concrete and building servers, but it'll be interesting to see if they actually do something beyond their current offerings of MobileMe and iTunes, and whether or not they're going to launch their own version of Office Online or apps online. So,
or sort of a BitLocker thing seems possible as well, storing all of your media that you purchased from the iTunes store in your own personal
account. Yeah, I mean, they already own most people's media, or at least the catalog for most people's media. So I don't know if that's really a speculation or just at this point there'll be something there. Next up, there was a little bit of activity in the standards world around cloud computing. James Urquhart from the Wisdom of the Clouds had a post, we'll link to that in the show notes, about a couple of groups that are trying to help wrestle in standards here. But I think we sort of have standards. Unfortunately, or fortunately, the de facto standard is Amazon Web Services. And every other cloud service, whether it's any kind of infrastructure as a service, is always compared to Amazon. Even Microsoft and the Azure platform is compared to Amazon. So I'm not really quite sure exactly what these folks are going to work on. I've spent a lot of time earlier in my career in standards bodies. I'm not sure that it's necessarily always the best use of people's time, but we'll see what happens there. Also, another bit of news, there was a report, I think it came out of a university in Australia. I picked this up from the blog Software Interrupted by Dave Rosenberg about cloud services and not being able to handle the pressure. And really what it comes down to is that there are some concerns about performance and some concerns about availability. And of course, that's going to be the case. Anytime that you're using a cloud infrastructure, you're giving up something in terms of raw access to the hardware and being able to configure your own robust Ethernet networking setup. So I think that's just a price that you pay. And as far as availability, I still ask people the question, is Amazon's availability or Rackspace's availability or any cloud availability any lower than what you would have in your own office? And to me, the answer is not really. Another big item, this is a little indirectly related to some of the cloud infrastructure, but there's been an increasing attention to how we deal with real-time information and how all the services that are relying on real-time information can avoid having to ping each other a million times over, which is really an ineffective use of bandwidth and network architecture. So there's been this emerging effort coming forward called the PubSub Hubbub, which Google has been a big proponent of. And now Google Alerts are using this capability, which basically, the way I understand it, PubSub Hubbub enables sort of these super nodes to reside in various places that act as traffic managers for sort of like RSS updates of people who are publishing information, and then being able to feed those updates to people who are tracking or subscribing to those kind of feeds. And so it seems to me that with the introduction of this, and we've just lost all patience whatsoever for the ability to wait a few minutes, and everything it needs to be instant. So I don't think the clock is turning back on that front, so we might as well just buckle our seatbelts. And then, a couple of interesting news items on the Hadoop front. One is there was a really interesting article just a couple days ago in VentureBeat, and the title of the post there was Mass Scale Computing, Why Hadoop is Hot and Java is Not, But Java is Not. And, there's this debate amongst developers at times between C++ and Java. On the one hand, you've got some benefits of some raw performance capabilities, but maybe a little bit more complex programming model. On the other side, you've got an easier programming model, but perhaps less performance capabilities. The author of this article claims that there's a 30% difference. And he also points out that the implementation of MapReduce, which is really Google's implementation, they call it MapReduce, is based on C++, whereas Hadoop, which is the open source implementation, is based on Java. And he's claiming that's a big deal. What do you think, Mark? Is it a big deal? Or
I think it's really not. I would say that these benchmark differences between different programming languages are really a red herring. When you're looking at switching a particular task in the real world and getting it executed, getting the query to respond to you, you're not caring so much about how fast each processor is working. Really, there are two factors that are driving tremendous improvements that really matter to us in the business. One is switching to doing this in parallel, switching to using the grid is already giving you a factor of 100 improvement over doing it in an old linear or single core kind of approach. So we're already getting tremendous benefits there. And then the second piece which comes with it is if there is any sacrifice in the coding, it's dwarfed dramatically by how fast and how straightforward it is for our developers to get you to the answer that they want. So if someone's composing a query, they're spending the majority of their time designing the query, thinking about what they want, thinking about how to get it out of there, and whatever language they're most comfortable in, the difference really washes away.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more when we get into our Q&A about how you go through that process from a business perspective and setting up those queries. So, but in the big picture of things, you're saying maybe this is blowing things out of proportion. Maybe it's more of just a preference debate of whether somebody likes one language or another.
I'm saying if you spend an hour working on the programming part and then your job runs for 1 hour, even if it is 30%, which I'm not going to stipulate, but even if it were, in the grand scheme of things, that's not the major concern.
Right, right. And then last item for our news before we jump into the detailed Q&A, Hadoop World is upon us. So, Cloudera being one of the real flag wavers for the Hadoop community announced the event, which will be on October 2nd in New York City. There is a roster of who's who of other companies, including Yahoo and Google and others, who are going to be there, as well as users of Hadoop. So it will undoubtedly be, a big bang of activity there. You had a question about the roster.
I was surprised on Cloudera's website to see that Google was mentioned. I hadn't heard about Google actually using Hadoop. If it's true, it's tremendous validation for the project. And, referring back to the piece about C++ and Java really underscores the point that it's kind of a moot issue.
Yeah, and I think this is the kind of thing, too, where, there's going to be multiple flavors, and undoubtedly we already have a couple of different distributions of Hadoop, and you can't say that one is better than the other. They're going to be good for different purposes. I actually think that we're going to see some more specialization there over time, but it'll be interesting to watch that. Hopefully the Hadoop World organizers will be caught up with making all that information readily available to a broader audience as well. That seems to be the trend with all conferences these days, making the videos and presentations available. So we'll hopefully see that stuff in about 6 weeks or so, I guess. Great. Well, that's a wrap up for the news. Let's jump into the Q&A with Mark, since we have him here today. Mark, why don't you just tell us a little bit about your start at Yahoo, how you got here, what you were doing initially, and some of the problems that you were looking at in the spam arena and Yahoo Mail arena.
Sure. So, as you said in the introduction, I run product management for the mail backend infrastructure, which includes the storage, the search, and then a lot of the delivery and anti-spam and abuse filtering, abuse prevention. And when we're looking at security, really a universal truth that we have to contend with is that attacks can come from anywhere, and when you're defending, you need to make sure that everything is protected.
And when you say everything, what do you mean?
Well, in the physical world, it means that you need to make sure all your doors and windows are locked, and the bad guy only has to find one of them that's opened. For us, what it means is that we're accepting billions of email messages every day. We need to make sure that every single place that a message can come in is appropriately guarded, is appropriately protected against, as well as our web interfaces. There are people out there that'll try to do bad things logging into our site. We need to be really vigilant that we are watching every different aspect, every different attribute of those actions to try to find any patterns, any abuse, and then mitigate it as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm. So from the time, when did you become familiar once you got to Yahoo with the Hadoop activity and sort of how much was in place and walk us through a little bit of some of your eye-opening experiences about where you, once you learned about it, maybe where you could apply it elsewhere.
Sure. Where it came from, or it came to my attention, was some of the developers on our team going to a tech talk, an on-campus presentation about Hadoop, about using the grid and how you can migrate your tasks onto it. Yahoo, as many of your listeners probably know, has been a longtime proponent, one of the major contributors to Hadoop for many years, and we've been using it in our search advertising and a number of different businesses around the company. So we've built up some gigantic clusters, and among those are a few experimental clusters that we have set up right now so that anyone within the company can just try out a project, get a feel for it, get a sense for how they load data on, how they can start getting value, and then if it makes sense, they take the plunge to actually create dedicated equipment which has the SLA, which has the guaranteed uptime and the guaranteed bandwidth and storage that they might need for a production application.
Right. Now, let's take a step back. Some of the listeners might not be completely familiar with exactly what Hadoop is and how it works, and maybe you could pick one of the early implementations that was underway as a way to explain sort of what it is and then how it was put into practice.
Sure. What it is, at the most basic, is a supercomputer. It's a system or a platform that allows you to connect together many, many computers that can all work on a single task. It's a very clear divide and conquer, you know, many hands make short work type approach to saying there are a lot of tasks that we do out there, particularly in the abuse space, that involve, that are easily subdivided so that you can have a bunch of different computers each working on a different facet. To give an example, when I was talking about abuse, about needing to protect all of the different, you know, ingresses and egresses, all the different vulnerabilities or potential vulnerabilities of a site, what we need to do is to examine many different features side by side, looking for a pattern, looking for a common trend. The way that this fits into the Hadoop mindset is we come up with an identifying characteristic. Let's say we've noticed that there's some spam that's coming from one particular IP address. And we want to find any other IP addresses that are sending the same sorts of messages as we got from that first one. So we've got all the subject lines that came from the first IP, and then we want to look across all of our machines, all of our logs, to see if anyone else, any other IP, is sending those same subject lines.
And that the idea there is that's giving you some insight into how the bad guys are sending out mail, or
it's giving us insight into how they're doing it, and what it's also doing is helping us extrapolate. So we don't want to wait for every IP to do something bad before we shut it down. We want to say these are all about to do something bad, so let's shut them down preemptively. So the way that we approach that in this Hadoop, in this grid world, is by taking the entire set of our logs, chunking it up into maybe 100 different pieces, and then having each node of this supercomputer working on just its little piece. So then the generalization is anytime you have a needle in a haystack type problem, it's very easy to subdivide this to say, not just one big haystack that I need to go through sequentially, instead let's chunk it up into 100 little ones, and have each of those look through it very quickly to see, did I find the needle? Did I find the needle? Did I find the needle? And then you coalesce those results back together.
Right.
So your many hands make short work. You've divided the problem up, approached it all in parallel, and then reassembled the results very quickly.
Right. So how did those kind of functions sort of change the game for the mail group in terms of what they could or could not do previously versus what became feasible?
It's giving us several orders of magnitude improvement on the ability to search, the speed of a search, a query like I just described, as well as making certain searches possible that weren't before. I'll clarify. On the first one, when we are looking at, we have, you know, one of the world's largest email platforms. We have more than 300 million users.
I think it's the largest, right?
It varies depending on where you look, but, you know, it's a gigantic system, very, very complicated. Very, very large volumes of data being produced. And if we're trying to look through that haystack, trying to find these trends, it's frequently too large a data set for any one system to handle.
Mm-hmm.
So in the past, not only can we do this very, very quickly, but it wouldn't have been possible in the past to collect all of the logs, put them in one place, and then say, go through this and find
as a single machine,
what traffic.
Single
as a single machine, right. Even as the most beefy machine we have. You can't put it all in one disk. You can't get through it all with one processor, and even if you could, it would take hours and hours to get through.
Right.
One example, I was talking to a developer this morning. He said that there's a task that he used to have that would take about 1 hour to process about 1 hour's worth of data. He is now able to process a week's worth of data in about 30 minutes. So that's
a week's worth of data, meaning like a week's worth of email of a particular
flavor
something.
Of email spread out over 7 days, over 168 hours. Mm-hmm. He's able to crunch through all of that much faster because he's able to use this divide and conquer, because he's able to use the Hadoop framework to create a very simple job that gets farmed out to many, many hosts, and then the results are very easily collected back together.
Right. Now, you've mentioned to me that you're working on some new Hadoop projects. What, can you tell us sort of what you have in mind for some new things coming down the road?
One of the major innovations that this enables us to do is to start looking at multiple facets at the same time. So, for example, this is a technical show, so I can use a technical analogy. Right now, we do a lot of abuse prevention and detection based off of IP address.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, and your listeners know, we're just around the corner from taking our 32-bit IP addresses and going to IPv6, going to hundreds and hundreds of millions of IP addresses showing up all across the board.
Right. This is sort of like a Y2K for the folks who have to deal with IP addresses.
It's a Y2K scale problem for us, yes. And so what we're looking at is how could we possibly scale our existing systems to be able to find patterns when you're dealing with hundreds of millions of IP addresses that might show up. I mean, it's 2 to the 128th. It's not even hundreds of millions. Billions and billions and billions.
Right.
So the migration that we're doing that is unlocked by moving to Hadoop is being able to deal with problems that are this much larger, that have the complexity that is now, you know, hundreds of orders of magnitude larger, such as the IPv4 to IPv6 migration, and still be able to find trends and patterns that exist among that vast data set.
Right. So, I mean, is there an alternative to using Hadoop in this case?
At this point, it seems, I hate to say it's a silver bullet or it's a panacea, but for many of the problems that we face day in and day out, Hadoop is the best way forward. We're seeing tremendous success from it. Everyone's excited. Our entire engineering team is getting trained up, or has already gotten trained up, and is investing seriously in migrating almost every single one of our filters onto a grid or a parallel infrastructure like Hadoop.
Right. Now, as I understand it, Hadoop is still an offline process. So it's not necessarily right in the workflow of how a web application or an internet-facing application is actually processing stuff. Tell us how that, you know, fits into the mail and the spam environment that you deal with, and what things are you looking at or investigating to make it more real-time or close to real-time?
Yeah, I think there's a term people use, nearline, which is somewhere in between, saying that
right. You
know, it's still a batch, but it's a batch that's happening very quickly. It's a small batch, and we're, you know, quickly catching up. I think one of the challenges, and again, I'm not the developer who's writing this, but I am managing the group that works on it. One of the challenges that we contend with is when you are farming out a job to a bunch of commodity machines out there, to a Hadoop cluster, you're not entirely sure how quickly you'll get the response back. There's redundancy built in because you know that some of these machines might break down, they might have, you know, failures, they might have
sluggishness. Right. The system is designed to work on industry standard hardware, assuming that drives are going to fail and nodes are going to fail.
Correct. What that means is that we don't know exactly how fast the response will come back yet. So we're fairly early in using it for full production capabilities because we need to learn. We need to
right, but that's
spend
sort of a matter
seeing.
Of time of using machine learning and checking the stats over time. How long did the job take? What's the median mean distribution and so forth?
It is. There's also a component of investment of saying, you know, do we want to have dedicated nodes that are just sitting there waiting? Of course, you know, one of the great benefits of the cloud is that you don't necessarily need to over-provision for your biggest spike. What you can instead do is have a pool of machines, a cluster, and you use the ones you need, and the rest of them stay in the pool for someone else. If we want to get to real time, we need to decide that it's worth investing in having dedicated machines that might be just sitting there idle, waiting for a job to come through, because when that job comes, you need to be able to act on it quickly.
Right. So that's a classic, you know, you sort of pay for what you get kind of thing. Let's jump a little bit, and I really want to go back to something you mentioned at the beginning, sort of designing the queries or the logic to find a particular answer.
Yep.
How time-consuming is that, both from the time that you need to think about structuring the problem, the time from a programming perspective that's required to set up the logic, and then execute it, and maybe just give us some examples and walk us through, you know, the steps of solving those problems. I mean, one of the things about Hadoop is it does sort of these, you break things down into simple steps, mm-hmm. compared to the more traditional relational database models where you could do very complex queries,
yep.
You know, all up front and then you know, wait for the machine to handle it. Hadoop kind of flips that around a little bit. Give us your take on that.
It flips it around, or it exposes you to the details a little bit. I was talking to some friends at another company that also uses Hadoop, and they have a SQL interface. They have a traditional database interface on the front. SQL, as you know, makes things very, very simple. You think about what you want, you phrase it in this language, and then it goes off and does it. And there's an optimizer built into the database that figures out how to make the job happen. This friend was saying that they actually run into problems at their company. Because it's so easy, people are crashing the grid occasionally by just running a ridiculously complicated job. With Hadoop, there are a number of different ways that you can write your program. There's a streaming approach, there's something called Pig Latin, and then there's several of these SQL or structured query language approaches. With the first two, at the current level that we are, you need to understand and think about a little bit more how your job is going to execute. So that means instead of just saying select star from this table where, you know, date is greater than September, what you need to do is think about, you know, how are things structured, how is the data spread apart. You're getting a little bit deeper into it.
Right.
But not so much that it's really intimidating, just to the point where, you know, somebody is thinking about performance, is thinking slightly about, you know,
right.
what is the
Can you give us a sort of generic male example of, you know, here's the question that we wanted to ask, and that here's the three or four steps that we had to break it down into from a Hadoop perspective?
Yes. A typical abuse action that we're trying to act upon is that we're taking some pattern that we've identified, and we're trying to extrapolate. We're trying to say what else is happening that's similar to this, because we want to make sure to close all the doors. So we find that there's sticking in the spam realm, because people can all relate to that. We see that there's some, you know, Canadian pharmacy spam that's trying to come through, and it's coming from a particular IP address. So what we might do is identify this IP address and then say what else is coming from that IP address. So we'll list out, let's say, the different subject lines that are showing up there. Then...
Okay, so just specifically in that case, somebody might be doing some, you know, buy these pharmaceuticals. Somebody might also be saying, you know, you've won the lottery. So a couple different subjects of spam messages could be coming from the same IP address.
Coming from the same IP address. Okay. So we've identified four different campaigns. So that's what we're starting from. Now we're turning to the grid to say, let's look across all our logs and extrapolate as far as we can to see who else should be blocked based upon this. So we take
based upon a pattern recognition of, is another IP address also have this combination of campaigns or what?
Yes. So we're now going to take these subject lines, these campaigns, and turn to the grid to try to find out, are there other IP addresses that are sending similar campaigns that we might want to block? Are there other patterns that are coming from these campaigns that we can extrapolate? Maybe
right.
we see, you know, Viagra 20% off, Viagra 25% off. Is someone else sending Viagra 26% off? And we want to, you know, catch
right.
those in the same net.
So what are some of the steps, the process? You know, you have to do a couple of runs of these jobs in order to get there. So walk us through what those actual steps might be.
Okay. The framework is MapReduce. And the way this works, the first task is map, is where I'm starting with a vast data set and trying to translate it into a series of key and value pairs. That is, you know, little facts about it that I'm looking for. In this case, where I'm taking the various subject lines, what I might want to do is to go through a typical log and say, let me pull out, for every message, each row would be a message, show me the IP address that it came from and the subject line that came from that IP address.
Okay.
That would be a key value pair,
okay.
and this would be a mapper. We'd create that mapper and set it loose on a whole variety of logs, going out and identifying the IP address and the subject lines. Then what I want to do after writing this mapper is move to the reduce job. The reduce job takes all of these different key value pairs and aggregates them back together into the business conclusion that you want. In this example, it would be taking these lists of IP addresses and subject lines and saying, show me all of the IP addresses that sent out a particular subject line.
Mm-hmm.
We'll fixate on one that we like, let's say Viagra 25% off, and get a list of all the IP addresses that sent that out.
Gotcha.
We then might chain it into a next step. So now we have a list of IP addresses that sent out one subject line we know is bad. Now we want to see what other subject lines all of those IP addresses sent out, so that we're, you know, fanning back out again to say maybe they're also selling Cialis, maybe they're also selling, you know, a Nigerian oil ministry. So we then write another mapper that says, taking each of those IP addresses, show me all of the subject lines that they had.
Right. So, and you're really breaking it down into these very simple steps.
Each one is a very simple step. It's quite straightforward to think through, even from the product side, even from the business side. You're just identifying, what do I want? First, I want to take all the messages. Then I want to subdivide them by all of the IP addresses that sent one particular subject line. Then I want to say, find all the other subject lines that those IP addresses sent. And you can imagine repeating this again, lather, rinse, repeat, until you've got the complete list of subjects and IPs that are related to one
spam
campaign.
Right, and I think that the part of it that's so amazing for me is that we're not talking about a couple hundred rows that you could fit in an Excel spreadsheet.
Correct.
We're talking about billions of messages.
Yeah, so we routinely block a billion messages a day. I mean, we're blocking spam messages up the wazoo. People are attempting to get their frauds out there, and we're constantly working to stop it. So we're dealing with these gargantuan data
sets. Numbers are staggering.
Numbers are staggering, and we need to work on it quickly because the spammers are out there trying to innovate, trying to get past our defenses as quickly as possible. We couldn't wait 12 hours to get the results of this job back. We need to be able to act on it quickly so that we can shut it down as fast as possible.
Yeah, yeah. So you've been in the trenches now with Hadoop for a couple years. Just give us some big picture perspectives about where you see the greatest fit, you know, maybe both inside Yahoo, other areas, but also just, you know, computing at large, where what you hear people talking about, where Hadoop might go over the next year, two, three.
We're using it beyond just the abuse space here at Yahoo and even within Yahoo Mail. Where it works really well is whenever you have large data sets and you're looking for some sort of pattern or commonality or co-occurrence within it. So anytime that we're doing, in the machine learning world, frequent item set mining, co-occurrence analysis, or any sort of pattern detection against a large data set, Hadoop seems to be a good fit. We're using it for our logs on any of our back-end systems and many of our front-end systems as well, just to pick up on standard errors. You know, someone tried to execute a search and it returned in greater than 50 milliseconds. Who else is having that problem? What other problems are those people having? It's the same sort of process.
Mm.
Anytime you've got lots and lots of data and you want to find some sort of smaller pattern or trend, this seems to be a perfect framework for doing so.
Great. Final question. For people who are considering Hadoop, do you have any words of wisdom, words of advice of, you know, things to think about from a big picture? Say, oh, you know, we've got a lot of data, we're having a problem, we're thinking about it, you know, what should we do?
One piece that we experience is that you don't need to start huge. You don't need to be thinking about data centers with thousands and thousands of nodes to get benefit. In fact, there are some benefits even at a linear pace. Even just with a 5 or 10 or 25 node cluster, you can start seeing a 5, 10, or 25 times improvement in certain types of jobs. So it shouldn't feel like an impediment. It shouldn't feel like something that only Fortune 500 companies can enter into. Secondly, as far as building the business case for it, doing the experimentation, understanding that there is some value there, has been tremendously, you know, helpful to us, just building a business case even internally within Yahoo. So I would think that the flexible grid stuff that Amazon is doing might be an interesting way to start. People could say, well, let's plunk down a few $100, just buy some time for, you know, it could be even just days, run a job and just get a feel for queries that you couldn't previously do or that you couldn't previously do in a reasonable amount of time. Start seeing how that might work, how that might apply to your business, and then you can grow from there.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much for sharing all that detail with everybody.
Yeah.
It certainly is, it feels like we're on the cusp of a lot of great things with the Hadoop community, so we'll look forward to staying in contact and seeing what happens.
Yes.
Let's jump into the final section of the show, Cloud Tips, where we pick an interesting consumer-facing or business-facing cloud application or tool to share with the listeners. I'll go first. This isn't a new one, but I'm just relaunching a company blog, and so my pick for this week is TypePad. It's been a while since I used TypePad in the past, but I do have to say that for a fairly nominal fee of something like $14 a month, you get great support and service, and for somebody who doesn't want to muck with the internals and just wants a really easy, well-supported way to set up a blog, TypePad is it. And just last week, it was really funny. We first set it up, and we'd gone to get all of these plugins to have integration with Facebook and Twitter and did umpteen other services. And, of course, right after we set that all up, TypePad announced a new version. So all that's built into TypePad. So it's very convenient. And I also have a re-tip. This was a tip that I did a while ago, but I'm using it again as we're going through some work email changes and restructuring. And I just want to have another tip for Google Calendar Sync with the BlackBerry, which has just been a savior for me. Whether you're doing it with Google Mail, whether you're using it to sync with Exchange, it's provided a lot of value. So,
thanks for plugging the competition on my show.
Yeah, wasn't my intent, but that's my other tip. So, how about you?
Well, because I work in the security space, I thought it might be relevant to talk about passwords. In the olden days, people used to say, never write your password down. You need to just commit it to memory and then burn all traces of it. But actually, right now, that doesn't make much sense. What we would say is that if you can keep your password easily in your memory, it's probably not strong enough. It's probably something that people are out there potentially able to guess. So I actually would recommend you create strong passwords, the kind that are such a pain in the butt to do with lowercase and capital letters and numbers and symbols, and that you do write it down. Now, the problem with writing it down is it's tedious to carry around a piece of paper all the time, so this is where the cloud comes in. One of my favorite services is called Passpack, PASSPACK.com, and what they do is provide a fully encrypted server-side or cloud storage of your passwords, but they do it with an interesting twist. Most of these companies require you to trust the person that's providing the service. You need to trust that this startup company out there is not going to just look at your password and go log into your bank account. What Passpack does is they have an encrypted virtualization layer, really. Basically, what happens is their servers store a totally encrypted blob of code that is decoded on your local browser. It's done using JavaScript, so it's all happening locally. In fact, if you want to test it, you can log into Passpack and then unplug your network cable from the wall and do the decryption right there. Nothing is sent back and forth to them. It's all happening locally. But then once you've done it, you have access from whatever computer you're on to log in immediately to the site.
Neat.
So I think it's a great application of using the cloud without compromising security and, in fact, enhancing security for the users.
Excellent. And we'll put links to all that in the show notes. Well, that's a wrap-up for today's show. Mark, I want to thank you again for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Any place you'd like people to know about as far as follow-up things about Hadoop or similar?
We've been putting a lot of information up on developer.yahoo.com. There are a number of talks there about Hadoop. There was a recent user community meeting, and there's a lot of discussion going on there. Developer.yahoo.com is a great source for information on Hadoop, and there's also some information about our applications in the real world to using Hadoop to help fight abuse and spam across the internet.
Excellent. We'll have a link to that in the show notes as well. That's it for today's show. Thanks very much to our listeners. You can visit us at thecloudcomputingshow.com or email us at thecloudcomputingshow@gmail.com. Maybe we'll need to get a Yahoo address as well.
Yeah.
And you can also subscribe on iTunes and there, just search for The Cloud Computing Show, and it should come right up. Thanks very much for joining us. We'll see you again next time. Bye-bye.